Okay, I'll open the meeting for Veterans Affairs for today, 120, no, today is the first, actually. So we shall start, and unfortunately for some of us, I will start this meeting on time. So that's the way it's going to be. And we have to do that for respect out of you people. So anyway, we'll start with, let Representative Matthews start off and tell us a little bit about himself, and we'll introduce ourselves.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I know all about him, though, so.
Greg Matthews out of House District 50, which is Gresham, hometown. Happy to be there. I'm a veteran of the U.S. Army, 1983 to 86. Served in Operation Urgent Fury, which was Grenada. And happy to be on this committee for yet my second term now. So looking forward to doing some great work. Served on the Reintegration Task Force this past, during the interim. And I know we've got some great proposals coming forward. So thank you all for coming. And, Mr. Chair, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
I'm Julie Parrish, and I represent House District 37, which is Tualatin and West Lynn. And coming to this from the military family perspective, being a soldier's wife here with the Oregon National Guard. So.
And then I'm Representative Esquivel out of District 6, which is Medford, Oregon. I am a veteran. In fact, I'm a combat veteran from Vietnam, which is back in the old days when we had the F-4B was our hottest aircraft back in those days. So, and this is my second or third year, I'm not sure, third term on this committee. So it's been my honor to serve the veterans of this state of Oregon. Representative Huffman just joined us. We want to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Represent District 59, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, Grant, Jefferson, parts of Deschutes, Clackamas, and Marion counties. Represent a lot of veterans, and so anyway, glad to be a part of this committee. Mentioned in the introduction a few weeks ago, a disabled veteran. Not a glamorous story behind that disabled part, but disabled nonetheless. And it's always a pleasure to work with Director Willis on projects and General Caldwell that we'll have here on the back row. He keeps losing weight, and I don't recognize him from looking good, General. So anyway, it's a pleasure to be on this committee and work with you gentlemen and for the sake of veterans.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to have informational hearings today, but I would like to have my co-vice chairs handle a meeting. I will turn the gavel over to them. I've been there, done that. Other people have been there, done that. But I think it's time that they had some time to do this, and an informational hearing is the ideal time. So at this time, I shall turn this over to Vice Chair and Co-Chair Matthews.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. But in the spirit of this co-governance model, I've had an opportunity to do this once, and I'd be happy to pass this to our co-chair.
That'll make it go real well.
We'll never do the second half.
Okay, great. All right. So we're going to open an informational meeting. We're going to begin with an overview and update from Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. And I believe coming to the desk looks like Tom Mann and company with Jim Willis. Thank you very much for being here. And to the panel, if we could just save our questions for when they're done with the presentation, that might help us kind of stay on track. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Willis.
Well, co-chairs and vice co-chairs and members of the committee, professional staff, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Jim Willis. I'm the Director of Veterans Affairs for the state of Oregon. And the purpose of me being here today is to give you a brief overview of the veteran situation in our state and an overview of our agency and how we respond to the needs of those veterans. So what we're going to do is we're going to put up a quick PowerPoint here. I'm going to go through it fairly quickly. And then as the chairs have said, then I'll certainly be happy to answer any questions or any comments that you might have for me. So we'll see here if our magic PowerPoint will come up. And I'm sure it will momentarily.
Need to be sick.
I see you're not asking Representative Escobar or myself for any technical support.
You want to know about a 16, talk to us, but other than that, we're in trouble.
You need a 12-year-old.
Pick mine from home.
The youngest, that young guy in the back there, he probably can.
Okay. Here we go. Okay, the first thing I think I'll do with the next slide is to tell you the population that we currently serve. And I'll try to give you source information on things that have statistics so you kind of know where this comes from. But every year, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs puts out national numbers on veterans and then breaks it down into various types of veterans by gender, sometimes by ethnicity, by degrees of disability, and so on. So the total number of veterans in Oregon today is 340,020. And the formula we use within the agency, just so everybody here will know, is that we believe that every veteran touches at the lives of at least three additional people who have a interest in the veterans in our state. So we're really looking at something over a million people that are impacted by these 340,000 veterans. And that helps us measure who we need to get information to and so on. The next one is the VA expenditure in Oregon, and I'm going to break this down in a couple slides from now as to how this comes into our state on an annual basis. But this is what the federal VA spends as a result of the veteran population in our state. It's a pretty big number, $1.6 billion. And this is how it breaks down. You'll see that it breaks down in compensation and pension at the $727 million mark, and then in education and readjustment, $47 million, and then the medical or construction at $750 million, and then insurance or indemnities is another $16 million. So if you roll that all up, that's what you'll get coming into our state. Now, how does it impact people? And that's the next slide. When we talk about disability compensation or pension, we're talking about 52,000 Oregon veterans that are receiving that, what we call comp and pen, compensation and pension. And then the GI Bill, and there's various iterations of the GI Bill that are currently available, is about 58,000. And then those that are enrolled in medical care, and you'll notice this is approximately one-third of the total veteran population of the state are enrolled in health care. That's important, and you'll hear there's more about this when we get into budgets and that kind of thing, because when these 100,000 veterans are receiving the VA health care, it means they're not receiving health care through DHS or through some kind of indigent services from other parts of state government. That saves general fund and, to some extent, the Fed matching funds to other component parts of state government. So our feeling is the more of these veterans we can get enrolled that are qualified for the help for the medical care, the better it is for our state. Then you'll see the VOC rehab program. There's 1,500 people involved in that. We get a lot of help in that program through the Department of Employment. They have a program called the Disabled Outreach Veterans Program, the DVOP program you may have heard of, where they're matching people up with vocational rehabilitation so that they can be reemployed, regardless of what their disability is. And then, of course, our latest homeless figures, and these are down, which is a happy thing to report to you from what I've reported in previous sessions, a little over 3,000 homeless veterans in Oregon. And, of course, you can see in the lower right there, and I believe you've been distributed this PowerPoint. If you haven't, well, okay, good. Then you'll see where we're getting our source data there. And I can't leave the homeless veterans issue without reiterating the statement of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki, who has as a goal, a national goal, to eliminate veteran homelessness in 5 years. And we're about a year and a half into that that challenge that he issued to all of us nationwide. And when he did that, we had something over 200,000 homeless veterans across our nation. He doesn't want any, and we don't either. We'd love to be able to report back someday to this committee that we've taken care of our homeless folks. And I'll get in later, if not this session, later in sessions, tell you some of the unique ways that Oregon is challenging the homeless veterans issues. Okay, then in general service areas, you'll see the claims and counseling, the campus veteran service officers, our Oregon Veterans Home Loan, and then the Oregon Veterans Home, which of course Representative Huffman is very familiar with since it's in his district, and then the conservatorship program, and then I'll get into each of these. Let me start with claims and counseling. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has a claims and counseling office in Salem where we take care of the veterans in Marion and Polk County. Claims and counseling for the veterans in the other 34 counties are taken care of through the County Veterans Service Officer Program, which, as it says here, that we partner with, and we certainly do. I like, as the director, to look at the system we have in Oregon as a safety net. And one of the guiding principles is that no veteran in our state should be denied the services that they are due and the benefits that they have earned by choice of geographic residence. So if they live in Lakeview, there should be in Lake County a service officer as competent as any other in the state to service their needs. The other side of that, as you saw with the home loan program, is we have a series of loan originators throughout the state. You shouldn't have to come to Salem to get a state veterans home loan. You should be able to go to a qualified loan originator, either a mortgage company or a bank, and do your home loan application and then be able to qualify for the loan anywhere you live in our state. Let me then go to our current budget situation. Did I miss the conservatorship program? I'm sorry if I... Oh, okay, I did get it. Okay. Let me talk about the budget for just a second, because this is a key figure. But in the 2009-2011 biennium that we're in right now, we had an allotment of $5.8 million to operate on. And I just want to tell you that for every $1 we spend in state general fund, we recoup $552 in federal money. Now, I'm not going to be critical of any other agency of state government. That's not why I'm here. But I am going to tell you that from a business standpoint, most of you are very familiar with the term return on investment, ROI. It's a guiding principle in any capitalistic society. And I just want anybody to tell me that they can beat the return on investment that the ODVA and our partners generate for state government. Now, does it go directly into the general fund? Certainly not. Does it help pay taxes and otherwise generate funds that eventually come into state government? Absolutely it does. So just think about that $1. When you think about our budget and what we're asking for this session, which I would call a subsistence budget, we're going to get our job done. There's no bells and whistles and there's no frills, but we'll be able to continue to receive these federal dollars by what's proposed in the governor's recommended balanced budget to this body. But we can have that discussion in more detail later on. One of the other programs that we have is the Campus Veteran Service Officer Program. That is another program that this committee will hear about in great detail. But when we established this program as a pilot, we did it by putting one service officer at Portland State, Oregon State, University of Oregon, Southern Oregon, and Eastern Oregon. Then we drew concentric circles out from those university base operations into the community colleges closest to those universities. And we put in office hours for the veteran service officers at the community colleges. That way we were serving the major part of the OUS system and 12 of our community colleges. I believe there's 19 total, but we were able to serve 12 with just 5 people. I think we have an excellent story to tell this body about the success of this program, and I think you'll find that not only the veterans, but also the veterans' families, and in some cases the survivors of those who were killed in action or those who are 100% service-connected disabled are receiving great service from these officers. And we're going to ask this body to allow us to continue that program, and there is a bill introduced before the body to do just that. Next, the Oregon Veterans Home Loan. I talked a little bit about that before, but there's some astounding numbers here.
Mr. Chair.
And let me stop talking because I see Representative Boone.
Thank you, Director Willis. Yes. Representative Boone, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to interrupt your presentation, Mr. Willis, but can you give us a bill number on that? Or do you have it?
I do.
Okay.
I absolutely have that.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate it. Break your stride, but
and I'll allow that question because it's pertinent to the current subject. Thank you.
Follow up. I am not in my stride yet, and people who know me know I'm not yet. But I don't know if it's due to the impending big birthday or whatever. But I would forget by the end of this meeting to ask you, so that's why I had to do it. Thank you for indulging
me. Well, Vice Chair Matthews and Representative Boone. In answer to your question, that is House Bill 2402.
Thank you.
2402. And my cell phone is off. I want you to understand. I do remember a few things from last session.
Here's
the
cell phone and the bill.
Okay.
Huh?
The phone and the bill for you.
In any event, just a review for the committee members that may not be aware of this, our whole agency's reason for being occurred because this body in 1944 saw that the World War II generation was going to come home. And when they came home, what were they going to need? Well, the federal government had already said they're going to take care of the GI Bill, so they're going to educate them. Clearly, there was going to be a need to employ them. So the state of Oregon determined the best need they could fill was a home. So they created the Oregon Veterans Home Loan Program back in 1944 as part of the reason they stood up ODVA as an agency. The very next year, in 1945, we began operations specifically for the purpose of making home loans. The other functions that I've described to you were added as we went on incrementally based on the need of the veterans. But you can see that we provided over $7 billion in low-interest loans to more than 330,000 Oregon veterans from the inception of the program in 1945 on. What I'm most encouraged by, and I hope you are, is the passage this last November of Ballot Measure 70, which made the Oregon Veterans Home Loan a lifetime benefit. Prior to that, you could only have a loan right from 30 years from date of discharge, and then you lost that benefit. Now, you can get a home loan when you're 75. As long as you live and are an honorably discharged veteran, you qualify. And most encouraging to me, on the part of the Oregon electorate, was they passed that measure, this is a constitutional ballot measure, by 84% of the popular ballot. That we took that, and I hope you do too as well, as not only an endorsement of an effective program that provides employment and stimulates our economy at a time when we need it the most, but as an action by our voters that said, we support veterans. We support our veterans, and we want to say thank you to them for what they've done. And they did it at the ballot box. So I hope I'm reading that correctly. That's the way I'm interpreting it. And I'm really proud of to be an Oregonian in that environment. So with that, I'll go to the Oregon Veterans Home, which our current home is located in the Dalles. We have 151 beds at the facility. 25 of those beds are in a ward devoted specifically to Alzheimer and other dementia. If we had that home to do over again, it probably would be between 200 and 250 beds, and at least 50 would be devoted to Alzheimer or other dementia. We are always oversubscribed in that ward. It's a tragedy, and if I might tell you just from someone that's dealt with that terrible disease in my own family, and some of you probably in your families, the thing from a journeyman standpoint that I would say one of the reasons I don't like it is because it causes people to leave before they go. Mm-hmm. And it's just heartbreaking. So we certainly supply data to the USDVA and others that we legally can give data to also provide research in hopefully finding someday a cure to either diminish or eliminate that horrible disease and some of the other dementia that we deal with. From a cost-effective standpoint, and this is primarily because we're assisted by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, we operate that home at about 60% the cost of a regular nursing home. And the one thing I want you all to understand, and some of you know this because you visited the home, that has nothing to do with the quality of care, the cleanliness of the facility, the dedication of the staff. It's top-level care. It has received two national awards, one of which has only been issued to two veterans home in the entire United States. There's 121 homes currently operating in the nation, and we're in the top 10% of the entire country. We are in the process now of building a second veterans home in Linn County, and just to give you some sense of that home, we will draw from probably Yamhill County North to Lane County South and everything in between, including the central coastal counties. So the catchment area that the Linn County home will serve out of Lebanon is about 100,000 veterans. That's the population section that we're looking to. The USDVA has said that those who are in need of assisted living or skilled nursing in our state, in our total veterans population, is about 900 beds. Well, we've got 151 in the Dalles. We're building 150 in Linn County. There is a proposal before this body to build another facility at Roseburg, and then I think you're going to see some other bills come out to have us do studies on the parts of the states that are underserved in terms of skilled nursing or Alzheimer or other dementia, and say, Mr. Director, what do we need to do to fill that gap? And I believe we're going to be required to come back during the interim and report to this body on what we found, and we're happy to do that. My concern, and one that I just want to share with you before we leave the issue of veterans' homes, is this. The largest cohort of veterans that we have in our state today are Vietnam veterans. That's our biggest number. And I have to tell you, without offending the co-chair here, since we're the same generation, we're not getting any younger. We're in our early 60s now, and some are even later. excuse me, Mr. Coach. I said we're in our early 60s now, and some are even later.
I'm still 39. I don't know what happened to you.
Okay. In any event, I think our responsibility operationally is to do what we're doing now with regard to the home that we're building, but strategically, we have a larger responsibility, and that is to do just-in-time presentation of facilities to meet the need of this body of people when they get there. And let's not forget we're still dealing with the folks that are still here from World War II and Korea. The World War II folks in their 80s and early 90s. The Korean War folks are in their late 70s and early 80s. So we're obviously dealing with them now. But now we have Vietnam vets in our veterans home. We're going to have more of them in the Lebanon home, and then others as they come along. The other thing that I'm sad to tell you is that my generation of veterans have suffered more illnesses on a per capita basis than the World War II vets did, and their mortality tables are higher for the number of veterans serving, and there's lots of reasons for that that we can get into at some other time. Let me speak just briefly about our conservatorship program. This is one of the most little-known programs within ODVA, and I think one of the most important. But this is for veterans that need help managing their financial affairs. It's usually court-ordered. We are given these folks by a court directive, and we manage their financial affairs because they simply are not capable of doing it. In some degree, it's kind of like a guardianship. You've heard that term before. The conservatorship's a little different than that. But we currently have 161 veterans that are being taken care of under our conservatorship program. We do that through what we call trust officers and assistant trust officers, and they all carry caseloads. And this involves going to their homes, it involves making sure their taxes are paid, making sure their utilities are paid, and then trying to work with them on the things they think they need versus the things that they should actually be spending their money on. And I'll tell you without using, I don't mean this as a humorous thing, but I will tell you that I often, in my 8 years as director, have gotten letters from some of the veterans we're caring for in this conservatorship who are very angry at their trust officer because they wouldn't allow them to buy a Cadillac Escapade, whatever the heck that four-wheel drive thing is, the Cadillac makes. I can't pronounce it, but that's why we manage their money, because they were going to make some decisions that weren't very good, or they wanted to move to South America or something like that. So we're able to give them a quality of life that allows them to stay in their home as opposed to being institutionalized or even being in a group home, and yet allow them to go on vacations. They have to be accompanied, usually by a guardian of some kind, but to live as normal a life as possible. And when I tell you that the conservatorship program is probably one of the least known, I can't imagine what would happen to these people if we weren't there. But I can tell you what I've seen happen. I've seen family members taking their funds. It's a shame, but it happens. I've seen other people alleging to be caregivers who wiped out their bank accounts and so on. Well, that doesn't happen when they're under our conservatorship program. That's why they're called trust officers. And also, this program is audited by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. It's been audited also through the Secretary of State's office, or excuse me, through the Treasurer's office, and that's fine. Audits is how you keep a good reputation, as far as I'm concerned. The other thing that happens in the organization is our home loan program is audited. The surveys are conducted at the Veterans Home in the Dalles, just like they will be when we open the one in Lebanon. We pay attention to those surveys when they're done by both the Department of Human Services at the state level and by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs at the federal level. Again, it allows us to come to folks like yourself and say, we have got a good operation, it's clean, and it's passed all of its surveys and its audits. So that's all about being capable of enjoying public trust, which I think all of us, everybody, elected and appointed, is all about. So we're really proud of this operation. We're a rather lean agency. We do all of this with 82 FTE and about 200 contract employees up at the home. So with that, Mr. Co-Vice Chair, I'm happy again that you invited us here to make this report. This, to me, talking about this agency is like talking about my grandkids. It's just great stuff.
Well, we always appreciate hearing from you, and we appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Representative.
For the committee, are there any questions? Representative Escobar.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Vice Chair. Director Willis, you know, you bit off a big chunk with trying to get the homeless vets. I mean, that's a big one. How do we take care of the ones that are here physically, but mentally they're still in country and they're away from people and they're away? I mean, how do you combat that?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, there's the, of course, counseling centers available throughout our state. We now have five scattered around the state that counsel people with regard to post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental challenges that are a direct result of combat. A couple of sessions ago, I testified that there are veterans who are homeless in our state because they want to be. I'm going to say that again. It's true today as it was two sessions ago. The reason that I say they want to be is because they don't want anything to do with the government, because they hold the government at all levels, mm-hmm. federal, state, municipal, county, all of them. They hold them responsible for the condition they find themselves in. Right or wrong, they hold them responsible. What is happening and what Representative Escobar has brought up that's changed in our generation, especially the Vietnam generation, is they're coming out from under the bridges and they're coming out of the woods, not because they want to, but because they're not well. They're too old. They can't exist. They can't live with some of the predatory elements that are existing in that environment today, because these people are younger and stronger. And so they're coming in, and what we're doing is this. We write letters every year for the nonprofits in our state who maintain the beds to put the homeless in. We've got great big operations going on in Portland. We've got them in Lane County. We've got them in Douglas County at the VA hospital and adjacent to the VA hospital. Then we have smaller operations such as the Oxford houses around the state who will take a veteran, but in most cases that's an alcohol or drug abuse issue. And then we have smaller operations like in Deschutes County where they have a place called the Home of the Brave. That's a five-person operation. But it's run by the local Central Oregon Veterans Council. There's another operation that just opened in Hillsborough in Washington County, same kind of thing, called Lacey's House. And we're seeing more and more of these kind of homeless care operations occurring at the grassroots level. And they are all eligible for this funding. Most of the VA's funding for homeless veterans is nonprofit funding. Sometimes it goes to the Salvation Army, sometimes St. Vincent de Paul's. Sometimes something like Central City Concerns, which is the big Portland-based operation. So one of the things these folks are very good at, Representative, is to match up the home care they're providing for the homeless with the counseling. And as an example, there's a counseling center in Bend. There's one in Grants Pass. There's one in Eugene. There's one in Portland. And there's one right here in Salem. So what the VA has recognized is we need to now deal with rural Oregon. So we need to get over and take care of Pendleton, and we need to get over and take care of the Burns, John Day, Ontario area and like that. Now, some of them go cross-border. So if you're in Ontario, they'll go to a vets counseling center in Boise, 60 miles away, you know, an hour away. But we have had very good luck in terms of health care of the VA recognizing that we need more of the community-based outpatient clinics. And now we've got one in Burns. Who would have ever thought we'd have one there? And we're getting more scattered across the state in the rural parts. And then we have a mobile veterans counseling center, which is a very large motorhome looking vehicle that's based here in Salem and travels, I bet it's on the road almost every single week of the year, going way over east, south, south central, and so on, that carries a accredited counselor on board, and they deal with these veterans, especially the homeless ones that the representative brought up a moment ago, who then are willing, because they're not going to a government structure, they don't want to go to a government building. But they'll go to this bus because it's just smaller and it just sits there and it's not intimidating. And they'll share with that counselor the things that are bothering them. And then if the counselor is able to earn their trust, they can get them into further counseling and maybe bring them back and, even better, sign them up for the health care that they probably need by this point. So I think that the Secretary of Veterans Affairs is putting his money where his mouth is in terms of homelessness, and granting the vouchers that we can use to get the veteran off of the out of the forest, under the bridge, and get them into housing. And some of this is individual housing, where they're capable of coming in, paying first and last, and then working in some kind of a rehabilitation program. And in some cases, in the case of one of the homes that I'm aware of in Roseburg, where they have 66 beds, there's a 24-month rule there. You can live there for 24 months. And while you're there, they're going to teach you the job skills. They're going to teach you how to do resumes. And they're going to match you with employers that have worked with them in the past. And the whole idea is that you're up and out and standing on your feet in that 24-month period. And they have a great record of success down there. They have very stringent rules in terms of conduct. But if you truly want to recover your life, that's the way to do it. And that's true in the Oxford House programs, and I forget, I have the numbers, and I'll be happy to bring them later, but there's many Oxford Houses in Oregon, and some of them are women only. So now we have a place where we can take our women veterans. And most recently in Deschutes County, they purchased a duplex, again for women only, and one other one for veteran total family. So now you're keeping the veterans together. You're not losing the kids, you're not losing the marriage, and we're maintaining employment for the veteran. So I think it's matching, Representative, it's matching the resources with what we actually have available and what programs have actually had success and worked in our state. So I am cautiously optimistic that we can meet this challenge. We've got 3,000 people to take care of. And I think together with our nonprofits and our faith-based providers that are in it all the way with us, we should get this done. We should, and I'd like to be ahead of that five-year challenge from the Secretary and say, check Oregon off the list.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to do that. Thank you, sir. Long answer to the question, I'm sorry.
Representative Huffman, then I'll get to Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Vice Chair. Director, always good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
Last time we were together, we both had shovels in our hands and breaking ground on an addition to the Veterans Home that adds a new dimension that would have been nice if we had thought about it and built it in originally, but at least it's coming. A large family activity room and whatnot. If you would indulge me a question, since I'm not going to get to work with you on your budget this session, regarding the Veterans Home and your budget for this coming biennium, are we prepared in the budget to take care of maintenance issues for the Dalles Veterans Home and the newer Veterans Home coming on? We have had some difficulties in the past identifying funds to do regular ongoing maintenance, and so are we able to identify the funds to do that?
Well, Co-Vice Chair Matthews and Representative Huffman, we do have money set aside for maintenance purposes. What we would like to do is have an industry-based maintenance fund that says this type of facility should have this much money on hand for normal maintenance. And so that's like a hospital or a clinic or, in this case, a nursing home. And those numbers are set by the industry. There's a standard amount of set-aside that you should have for maintenance. Well, we're not able to generate that kind of money. So what we do is we set aside what we call life safety maintenance monies, so that if anything happens to any of our systems that directly contribute to the quality of life of those residents in the home, we can react very quickly. As an example, if we had an HVAC problem, if we had a problem with the roof, if we had a problem with some of our food service equipment or any of our sanitary operations, can we fix it? The answer is yes, our history is we can. But in terms of doing an industry-based maintenance, we're just not going to be there because of the amount of money that's involved. But I'm confident that those things that we need to fix, we have the funds to fix them. And I think we can maintain that. And part of that is the generosity of Oregonians who simply make donations to that home. It's amazing. It's amazing. Sometimes we get $30, and the next time we turn around, we got one most recently, we got $75,000. So we make sure that that goes in a rainy day so that when something does happen up there, we can get it fixed and get it fixed quickly. And we have a full-time maintenance person on duty up there. And he's just dedicated to what he does, and we listen to him. And when he says, you know, pay me now or pay me later, we usually pay him now and get it fixed before it gets worse, you know, kind of like we do in our own home, I hope.
Good.
So that's
Thank
the
you.
Answer. And we'll use that, and to answer the second part of that, we'll use that same model with the next home as well. And we hope to have some upfront dollars before the door even opens so that we'll have sort of that rainy day fund I'm talking about that we use at the Dalles.
Great. Thank you. Representative Parrish.
I had a question, kind of switching gears.
Sure.
You know, the post 9/11 GI Bill has really changed who can access education. Are you seeing, the two-part question, so are you seeing spouses and dependents starting to access that? And then the other question is, if you start to see an influx, are you staffed enough to handle, you know, families accessing that benefit through the GI Bill?
Well, Co-Vice Chair Matthews and Representative Parrish, the answer is yes and yes. Yes, we're starting to see the family members accessing the bill. And for those that may not know this, this is a unique GI Bill that allows the member to pass the benefit to a family member, a spouse or a dependent. Those are not big numbers. I want to tell you that right now. There's not very many people doing that right now. But if that were to increase, then the next part of the question is, do we have the people that could give the advice? The answer to that is yes as well, and here's why. not only do we have these five that are dedicated to the campus program, but we also have, remember, those federally accredited veteran service officers in all 36 counties who in our annual training are trained on the Montgomery GI Bill. So a person, the veteran, their spouse, a dependent who is eligible, can go to the service officer and they'll lay out, here's how you can best use the Montgomery GI Bill. And in some cases, I've talked to veteran members who said, look, I don't want to use it for me, but my wife has a AA degree, and man, I'd sure like to see her get her baccalaureate. And so I'd like to pass that on to her. Or, even better, here's that dependent, and they don't have the funds to send that child to school. Well, now they do. And so the good news is, yes, they're using it, but not in very big numbers yet, but that's because it's just fairly new.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're ready, we'll be ready to help them understand all the ins and outs of it. And, well, you brought it up, Representative Parrish. I want to tell you one other thing. You talk about an economic boon to the Oregon university system and the community college system. This Montgomery GI Bill is the best thing since the World War II GI Bill.
Yeah.
And a fact that's probably lost after all these years, in World War II, we put 16 million American men and women in uniform in the armed forces, 16 million. When they came home, almost half of them took advantage of the GI Bill for at least an undergraduate degree. Some went on for a graduate degree. And they literally created the middle class of this country. That's what happened as a result of the GI Bill in World War II. So we're not going to reach near those numbers today because our whole military is made up of about 1% of our total national population. But we are going to transition a whole group of veterans to a better life and be able to seek and maintain better employment as a direct result of this front-loaded investment through the GI Bill. And for the family members. I think it's just one of the best things we ever did for our military.
Well, that's the reason I asked, because, I mean, if we split ours three ways, I mean, you used to have an allotment that just was one person coming forward to you, but now you could get all three of my kids.
Yep.
And you're, you know, so when you start putting independents into that mix, that was the reason I asked about capacity. When you suddenly have multiple people from the same allotment using it, if you're staffed the right way. So,
well, if you talk to your community college and university presidents and provosts and financial aid offices, they'll tell you that this is sustainable because you don't question whether you're going to get paid or not. You're going to get paid. So you can hang your hat on, as an example, the 300 Montgomery GI Bill veteran students at the University of Oregon, that is a block of funds that's going to sustain that university. And the same thing's true at some of our community college levels. So my hat's off to the people who designed this particular bill. This was really a good idea. Thanks for that question. That's good stuff.
Any further comments? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I'm interested in that mobile counseling unit.
Oh, yeah.
How does it have a schedule, or is it by request, or what? Because I'm thinking about the coast, and I've heard from some constituents who are vets who say they need more transportation help to get them to Portland or whatever, but maybe it would be helpful to have it come down there to them, too.
Absolutely. It's both ways. What the staff at the Salem Counseling Center do, which is where that unit operates from, is they look at what are the scheduled veterans events. As an example, you may have all heard of what's a stand down. Mm-hmm. And when stand downs are scheduled, they're going to schedule that van to be there as one of the component benefits to all the veterans who come, many of whom are homeless. Okay, so that's the kind of scheduled event that they would go to. And then they will absolutely go on request. If the veterans in your county were to get together, or the county veteran service officer were to say, I would really like to have you over here for such and such, they'll work it into their schedule and they'll go.
Okay.
I'm amazed. I see these people all the time. And it's not just that they have this great new piece of equipment. And maybe one of the things we could do during sessions is bring it in and put it out here so that you can see it someday. It's right here in Salem, so... But like I say, it's gone almost all the time. But if we get a chance, we should bring that over and let you look at it. It'll make you feel like, okay, some of my federal money is actually valid, you know, that I'm using. So, but if you want it over at the coast, All you have to do, and usually the best way to do it is through your county veteran service officer or through your local National Guard armory, and they'll bring it over. You'll be happy. It's really a good piece of work that they do.
Any other questions from the panel? Thank you, committee members. And Mr. Willis, again, thanks very much for your testimony. I have one quick question, and that's a follow-up to the statistics.
Yeah.
We took strides to make a veteran is a veteran is a veteran. We defined that last session. So this might contradict that, but I'm curious, are the numbers able to be broken down fairly easily on how many of those are male and how many of those are female veterans?
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if we can get that. And also, from a demographical standpoint of ages, if there's a disparity in ages, how young are we seeing our veterans reaching out for services and how old are they? And if we could get those, would that be something, Coach Escobar, you'd be interested in seeing?
Very much so.
I could give you that. And then the other thing I think I should also give you, even though you didn't ask for it, is what's the breakdown on disabilities from the 0%
mm-hmm.
disabled vet to the 100% and to the unemployable? We have all those of that 340,000 that we're dealing with.
That'd be great.
Because disabled veterans is another issue that we need to deal with. But, yes, we will get that back in a little one-page fact sheet for you.
Well, once again, we'll be seeing a lot of you this session.
Oh,
thanks
yeah.
for all your work and to your staff. And actually, the audience is filled with folks who are working on veterans' issues, and thanks very much for your efforts.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for having us here today. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
I got to give it
up. Got to give.
Can I close that or no?
Yeah. You don't have to. We're open.
Shucks.
Next, we'd like to invite General Caldwell up, but before he speaks, I would like to make a couple comments. One is that our committee administrator is new to the building. It's Jill Petty, but her father was a career officer in the Air Force. And her father was a general. So she can pull rank on you at any time, General. I just want you to know that.
Most anybody can do that.
Also, our assistant is Cynthia Scott. Are you Cynthia Scott? I've never met you, but welcome aboard. And we appreciate having these fine ladies here to help us because without them, we'd be lost. So, and we all know that, don't we, ladies? Yes.
You would be lost.
Yeah, I know.
So,
that's right.
What I wanted to say was I was hoping that Jill was going to let us know that her brother was Tom Petty and she could get him here.
There you go.
Long burner, $50.
Yeah. Yeah, $50 tickets. That's a stretch.
So anyway, without further ado, before you start, General, I'm going to turn this over to our other co-chair.
Oh, goodness.
And give her a run and let her have a chance at the gavel, because I think that's imperative that we all do that.
Just pound it a lot. Throw it at him. I'm sorry.
I think we're still in the middle, so there's no pounding.
And
to
don't
do.
Listen to Representative Boone.
Yeah, I'll be her guide.
Well, welcome, General Caldwell. Glad to have you here.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, or Co-Vice Chair, excuse me. I'll get this down. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I would request in the future that I don't follow Jim Willis. That's always a hard act to follow, so I would appreciate it if you could move me before Jim. And always informative and always a great supporter of all the veterans in this state. The request that I got wasn't to give you an overview, so I apologize. I could do that. We have one prepared, and I can bring it at a later date. But the request that I received was to talk more specifically about what's going on in the Oregon National Guard, and particularly with the suicide rates that have been proceeding.
General, we all know you, but for the record, you need to say who you are.
I apologize, Co-Vice Chair. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. Excuse me. You'd think by now I would know that. But so I actually prepared a little packet for you that should be coming around that gives you kind of some of the information that we're seeing with respect to that specific issue of suicides in the National Guard. And it is a concern, I can tell you that without any question. If you look at the chart, the colored chart with the bar graph on it, you will notice over to the far left that Oregon is the second leading National Guard entity in the country for suicides. It's a major concern of General Reese and the entire command of the Oregon National Guard. I will point out some other. There's an article that sits right behind that that expresses the concern of the National Guard Bureau. And what was fascinating to me was that statistically over 50% of the people who have committed suicide have taken their own life. Over 50% of them have never been deployed. So I don't, and there's a lot of really smart folks looking at this whole phenomenon. And I can tell you that there doesn't seem to be any single factor that one can point to that says, well, deployments cause it, relationships cause it, economic status causes it. None of those things seem to hold true throughout all of the statistical data that's been raised. We have, in the last year, as you will note, that in 2010, we had four suicides in the Oregon National Guard. None of those had deployed. They were all men, no women. We went back through our records. We've only had two females commit suicide, and that was in the last decade, and that was back in 2000 and, let me look here, 2001. We had two Air Guard. 2001, we had an Air Guard tech sergeant commit suicide. In 2002, we had an airman commit suicide, female. So those are the only two that we've had in the last decade of female members of the Oregon Army or Air National Guard. The National Guard Bureau has now established a policy that all suicides will have what we term a 15-6 investigation, which is basically an investigation by an outside of the chain of command officer who will look into all the relevant details around that and gather as much information as possibly can be gathered. The other interesting piece of this was that about 3 years ago, I got a call from the Department of Human Services here in Oregon, and they asked me to come over and talk to them about this subject matter, and I was curious as to what I could offer to this entire discussion. These folks have advanced degrees and have spent a good deal of time studying this particular issue here in Oregon. And they asked if I had any input based on the fact that they had noticed in the demographics that they had, or the data they had collected, that a high percentage of veterans were, Oregon throughout, not necessarily serving members, but veterans were in this classification of taking their own lives, using a weapon. Certainly had nothing to offer to them, but I also learned in that discussion that that Oregon at the time, and I don't know if this holds true today or not, but at the time, 3 years ago, was the highest rate per capita of suicides in the country. So, we have searched, without any success of trying to find some cause and effect relationship. We've gone into recently, as we started looking at these last four this last year, we went back and started looking at what we term the ASVAB test, which is a test that you take when you join the military, and Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, to see if there was any indicators in there that say all of them had the same low score in some category or high score in some category. If there's anything that would tell us, point to something that we could identify to say, well, do we need to deal with this? And then we looked at the four and started looking at their socioeconomic status, and there was no relationship there. We looked at their current economic status, and there was no relationship there. There was no ethnic relationship, and there was no, in two of the four, there was a relationship issue with, these were all males, and they had relationship issues with females. The most disturbing one that you may recall that made a lot of news was the young man that would return from Iraq with the 41st Brigade and was killed in Vancouver by local police officers. He was threatening them. He was taking drugs. He had alcohol. He was intoxicated, and he was threatening with a weapon. And they really had no choice. I mean, it was a thorough investigation. The Vancouver police was very forthcoming with us and helped us along through this whole process. So again, there was rumors floating around at that point in time that there was some pact between him and three of his buddies that had served together with in Iraq. We completely investigated the whole thing. All three of his closest friends were dismayed that he'd taken his own life. They didn't understand it. They said he had a mild relationship issue, but it was not a big deal in their minds. And there was no pact. There was absolutely no pact from the other three, which those things kind of occur when you see, particularly with the publicity that we had on that particular subject or that particular individual. So again, we've done a good deal of analysis, a good deal of effort. Also in your packet, by virtue of some assistance we received from Senator Wyden with the dreaded earmarks that you hear about, he got an earmark for the Oregon National Guard. We used that earmark to establish a couple of what we think are working very well. One of those is on the next page you have before you, is reference Fort Oregon, which is a website, a virtual website that we've stood up with those funds to put out to, on the net. So any veteran, any member of the Oregon Guard, any citizen for that matter, can get on this website, go fortoregon.com, fortoregon.net, and just put Fort Oregon anywhere, and their search engine is going to draw you to this site. And what it gives you is a menu of different, of a host of different assistances that are out there. Probably the fourth page back is a better, that's the front page, or one of the front pages, I guess. And it basically can guide you through a whole host of benefits, a whole host of counseling situations that are out there, both VA, through Jim Willis's organization, through the federal VA, through the local county veterans, and also the whatever may be out there in the community for the general population. So it's a menu. It's a place that you can get information. It's a place that you can do your own research on. And we established a relationship with the Oregon Partnership, who has established a hotline, which is depicted on one of these Oregon Military Partnership Military Helpline. And if you go to the very back page in my packet, I hope it's the last one, it says Oregon Partnership, which is their web page, and we have a link to that, and it has Military Helpline right there on the front page of their website. They've stood up a section of their normal suicide prevention and hotline effort just strictly for the military. They've manned it with a former Oregon National Guard veteran who served in Iraq in 2004 with the 2162 Infantry. And they've done a super job, and now our effort has been to try to get our soldiers informed, get them using not only this website, but also using Oregon Partnership website looking for assistance. A lot of times, soldiers don't want to tell their chain of command. They're fearful that they will have some sort of retribution or lose their status and not be able to be a full member of our organization. So we've tried to create these opportunities so they can go outside our typical network. They can get the assistance they need. They can find those resources on their own. All these kids are wired. Everybody's got a PDA. Everybody's got a BlackBerry, an iPhone, or iMac, or whatever they are, and they know how to use them. And so we're trying very diligently to get out of our age group's notion of how do you get information and put it in what these kids use today. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback on this. The site is robust. It's got a ton of information on it, probably more than any of us could probably use or need, but yet it's there for the soldiers, their families to use to get information, find the resource, and then research on their own, which is fairly typical of this type of individual we have in our force today. So that's pretty much the overview that I planned for you today to kind of give you just a little quick look at this one particular subject. As you know, or perhaps you don't, our reintegration team has been very successful. We've learned a lot through the last 7 years of this conflict. And in that 7 years, we know that if we deal with our people in the appropriate manner and give them as much information as many times as you can possibly give it within a year of the deployment, about 80% of them are going to get it. I can tell you that we've learned the hard way that you can't give this information to soldiers getting off an airplane and expect them to understand it and retain it. So we now have a 30, 60, 90-day process where 30 days we bring them back in. We have the same discussions they had when they got off the plane. At 60 days, and all these 30, 60, 90-day events are scheduled. They're ordered to be there. They're paid when they come there, and we want to bring their families there. And if they bring their families, then a lot of times we can get information from family members that we won't get from the soldier. And again, we're not trying to punish these people. We're trying to find out if we need to give them more assistance. And if so, get them directed to the right spot at the right time. Mr. Willis's van and his people support these reintegration efforts wholeheartedly. And we have great contributions from all of the different services, including the VA, other services, and DHS, housing, community development. All of those folks participate in this effort. So by and large, we're doing all we can at this point to try to get everybody in there. Are we getting them all? No, we're not. We know that. and usually we find out about the ones that we don't through the media or the local law enforcement. But I will tell you from just a thumbnail without a great graph or statistic, we're seeing less and less of the incidents where we're getting a call from the county sheriff to the reintegration team saying, I got one of your guys. We're getting more of our calls from our own members, from guard members and units that are saying, we got a problem, this individual's got a problem, and we're taking him to the VA now. So the units are more engaged than they were 7 years ago. It was kind of somebody else's problem, and that isn't the case anymore. So our chain of command, I think, has got the message. I know the chain of command has the message, and they're reacting to it. And they're reacting to it every single day. So from a reaction standpoint, we're much better at it, and we're much better at getting the information out to the families and the members. So those are the good news stories, I think, of what some of the efforts we've made, and it's been a great contribution from not only the legislature, but our federal delegation stood up. So we have nothing but high praise for the members of this body and the members of our seven members of our delegation, because they have really stood up. And they're continuing. It's not just a get the headline and move on. They're continuing to work with us. They're continuing to be involved in every one of our summits, which one's coming up. In about 45 days, we'll have another annual or semi-annual summit, and we bring all the partners in, and we bring anybody that's interested and ask, okay, what can we do better? What have we done well? What have we not done well? And are there any new ideas out there that we can inculcate into this thing? So with that, I will cease and be more than happy to answer any questions.
Representative Esquivel or Chair?
Just thank you. General Cole, is there any difference between our Iraqi people that have served in the Iraqi theater or the Afghan theater? Is there a difference in problems or challenges? Or have we
Madam
even Co-Chair, looked at that?
Representative Esquivel, I think anecdotally, yes, but it's minute. Everybody's experience is different, and I think that if you look at and if you really went through we've had over 13,000 individual deployments since 2002. So we're 13,400 now, I think, right in there. We've got approximately another 300 or 400 that are going to go out this next year. We just sent a unit to Afghanistan that just got there last week. So this has been a kind of continuum. What we've noticed is that everybody's experience, whether you're in Afghanistan or Iraq, they're all different. There is no set experience that's going to be like the guy that maybe you're in a unit with today when you get home. And by that I mean some of them are simply on a base like they would be in any place in the continental United States, and their job's fairly cut and dried. They don't move a lot. At a computer, doing whatever they may do. Difference is that every day they get mortars, which kind of racks, destroys their sense of safety to a certain degree. And then you have other people that are in the same unit that are going outside the wire every day. And they're experiencing IEDs, they're experiencing direct fire. And then you've got another person who maybe is in the supply business and working at one of the bases moving stuff, and that those experiences are totally different than, and yet they all come back to Oregon, they all get back in the same unit, and they don't have the exact same experiences, which has been kind of interesting to watch this whole thing. I would say that the unit that we sent, when the 41st Brigade went to Afghanistan and their job was to train the Afghan National Army, that experience, I think, was considerably different than anything else that we've seen. And I think mainly due to the fact that they were embedded with the Iraqi army, and they were training these Iraqi national police and the Iraqi army. And then when they got the training, then they went with them to the field. And so suddenly you have small advisor groups, for lack of a better term, that are actually in day-to-day combat, literally just every single day, whereas their counterparts maybe weren't. They were in the support business, and they're sitting back at the airbase or back behind the wire, and they didn't have any experience at all in that direct fire combat. We had two incidents where the deputy brigade commander had to go out and get people out of that situation because they're scheduled to change out every so often, so they would have new blood and give those guys that have been out in this day-to-day, every single day combat situation a relief. And we had two individuals that didn't want to come back. In other words, the helicopter came in, dropped off the replacements, and the guys who were supposed to leave didn't get on. And they said no, because they'd formed this bond with these Afghanis, and they did not want to leave the people that they'd trained from the day they'd started out their training, and they'd been in some terrific incidences. And they course, radioed back and said, tell them to get on the helicopter the next day. And they didn't follow the order. And finally, the deputy commander flew up and said, you're getting on the helicopter, I'm arresting you. And they got on the helicopter finally and left. One of those particular individuals, actually, we had a lot of concerns with, and we ended up making sure that he got significant mental health counseling. He came back to Oregon, immediately departed the Oregon National Guard, and then got back on active duty because he wanted to go back to that, and he wanted to go back to that theater. He was very upset with us, and so he left, and I haven't heard from him since. That's pretty unique. 13,500 people, one person has kind of gone to the other side that we can put our finger on. So, yes, they're all different. I think every experience is different. There doesn't seem to be a great commonality amongst some of it's common, but most of it's just pretty mundane and pretty routine. And then there's this small pockets of people that have really been in intense situations.
How many people, can I ask, are you got currently deployed from the National Guard that are in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, I'll defer that this isn't going to be exact, but right now we have about 800 to 900 folks. We got the 3rd Battalion, 116th, that's in Iraq, 1249th that just departed, and they arrived in Afghanistan last week. And then we have our CH-47 unit out of Pendleton, about 75 people that are in Afghanistan right now. And then we have a couple of small aviation pockets that are in Iraq. So that's total right around 800-850, I would guess.
And are they still looking at year-long tours for these smaller groups, or are they?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, they, right now the policy of the Department of Defense is to, from the time that they are deployed out of Oregon until the time they get back is no longer than 12 months. Mm-hmm. Most of the deployments of the last 3 years have been under the 12 months, usually 11 and a half. You know, they get right up to the wire, but we haven't had any of them extended in, since about 2006 that actually have been extended beyond the 12 months.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brigadier General. I'm always really nervous about using your title.
Me too. Makes two of us.
I just wanted to let you know, I just looked up your website, fortoregon.org, and it's very user-friendly. I'm not military. I don't have any military experience other than you guys here. But it was. I looked up several different areas pretending I was somebody looking for something, and it went right to it. So thank you. Good job.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Boone, we actually ended up, it was very fortuitous. You may recall Jacqueline Zimmer, who used to come down here and mm-hmm. come before different committees on aging. I think it was the aging population she was working with. And I didn't know that she had left that role, and she'd gone to work for this organization who has primarily started this kind of network called Network of Care out of California. And she literally just sent me an email to say, hey, I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm now with this group. And she said, you might check out our website. You might find something on there. It'd be interesting. So I checked it out, and we were struggling at that moment trying to figure out how we would get things done. And they just stood up a similar one for the state of California, and it was basically under the Veterans Administration, the state veterans operation in California. This is exactly what we've been looking for, to some place where people can get on and get information and one, you know, one-stop shop, if you will, on the web. And particularly for those that are in rural Oregon, that, you know, as Mr. Willis indicated, you know, you send the bands out, you do everything you can with county veteran service officers, but sometimes there's just a lack of resources out there, and it's understandable because of the lack of population. But if you can sit in John Day, Oregon now and get on the web mm-hmm. at 9 o'clock at night and figure out where these services are, even if they're in your county, and you put your zip code in, it'll give you everything that's in your county, and then it'll also say, but if you can't get it there, you can get it other places, and here's how you do it. So it is very intuitive. It's very easy to negotiate. It's easy to get in and get information, and we've had some very good reports. However, I will admit, I was out in Ontario last week, and I had a room full of soldiers, and I said, how many of you have been on Fort Oregon? And only one hand came up. And I said, well, how about your wives and your family members? And then three hands went up out of about eight. And I said, well, that's kind of our routine. We always believe in the Oregon National Guard that whatever we do takes 1 year to get installed. Because the first 6 months, they say, they'll have the flavor of the day next month, so we're not going to worry about it. And then the next 3 months, if we keep hammering on this, say, I wonder if they're serious. And then by the end of the year, and we bring it up then and say, well, they're serious. Let's start looking at it now. So it's about a 12-month process. And that's been only 40 years we've been dealing with that. So,
so quick follow-up. Just wondering if you, and you probably already have, but just, you know, send this information out to libraries and community calendars and things like that, so that people get them, get on them. Because I know in, just in Seaside alone, in the library, there are probably 10 or 12 computers. They're always in use. And then during the day, a lot of the times people are looking for work or whatever, but that would be an easy place for someone to go that's non-governmental, and they could look up, you know, some resources.
Madam Co-Vice Chair, Representative Boone, we had hoped with the money that we'd gotten from the Senator Wyden's earmark that we could use some of that to advertise. Our vision was to have on buses, you know, go to Fort Oregon and check it out, and, you know, lots of advertisement. Unfortunately, the money wasn't allowed for that. So we didn't have the budget to get it out and really advertise it. We have been using our semi-annual summits. We're getting good response from that, but that's a wonderful idea, and I'll bring that up to our folks and see if we can't hit the library network to let them know that, because I think that's the real key right now, is getting people informed that you can go to Fort Oregon, you can get something off of it, and it's a very robust site.
Any other questions? Thank you for coming.
You're certainly welcome. And if the committee would like a complete overview with a lot of more detail and a whole bunch of PowerPoint slides that I could have some trusty assistant that knows how to run these things down here to do, I would be more than happy to do that at any point in time. So it's all prepared. I just didn't bring it, and I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
So are you alluding to the fact they didn't ask you to come up and help them either, General?
That's right. Yeah, well, I actually, I carry this little thumb drive with me, and it's got a lot of the briefings that I use on it, and sometimes I've been caught, but I know the ones on here are very dated, and they're at least 6 months old or older, and I thought I'd probably throw that in that thumb drive and that computer just go tilt. Yeah. And then, and then your trusty administrator would say, hey, that guy ruined my computer. Yeah.
Sorry, Representative Boone.
We know where to find you. So, and just in light of the fact some of my colleagues here sat on the other version of Veterans and Emergency Services, which is emergency preparedness, and the general and some of his colleagues have some very good information, it would be very good for our our committee to have that be part of your overview, because even though we don't have a committee with that name, we're still going to need you when those times come. And you can brag about what you've done before, because it's really good. You should really hear about all that they've done.
Madam Co-Chair, Vice Chair, and Representative Boone, I would be more than delighted to do that, because our briefing does include the Office of Emergency Management that is part of the military department, and I am the interim head of that as well. So I get two jobs for the price of one. Not a bad deal, but it's been a lot of fun, been very interesting, even though they reported to me before. When you end up as the interim, you get to learn more details, and it's been exciting. And we've got some wonderful things that we're trying to get accomplished right now. And when I get back to the office, I'll look at the governor's budget and see exactly just how excited I am or not. So yeah, I'm sure Tom's already read it, but I haven't had a chance to look at it yet today. So we would, and just if you want to do it next week or whenever your schedule allows, just let me know. And I know that your able committee chair, administrator will do that, and then I will make sure and give you that whole thing.
Great.
We'd like that.
Oh, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Vice Chair. I just wanted to go on the record and alleviate any concerns that the general may have, that I'm going to let at least two committee hearings go by before I even bring up the subject of funding for the Dallas Armory. I promise. You're off the hook today.
Madam Co-Vice Chair, Representative Huffman. The good news is, and I did read the governor's three, four-page kind of summary of his budget, and the last paragraph in that four-page document had a statement, rather vague, but it said that he is working with the legislature to secure the bonding authority that we will need to do our facilities.
Sure.
So I don't know what devil's in the details, as we all know, but I thought, well, that was the only thing
we'll,
you said.
We'll
about
take
it.
A final vague paragraph, won't we?
It was better than no paragraph, is the way I looked at it. General Reese is in Washington, D.C. today, and when I saw that last night, I called him. I think I woke him up. It was only 8 o'clock here, so I thought that's okay. And I said, I sent this to you. You may want to look at it real quick. He said, I'll look at it in the morning. So, but I said, well, at least we got mentioned, you know, so it's not all bad.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So the agenda says possible topics to be discussed include female veteran suicide rates and transportation issues. Does anybody have anything that we're bringing forward for that today?
Nope, we didn't. Well, there's a couple housekeeping things I'd like to talk about. One, Representative Witt is very ill. He came back from the East Coast on an airplane, and somebody had the plague. So we've quarantined his office with a cholera flag, so do not go into his office. Then the other thing is for the committee itself, we are striving to do paperless. And if you do not want to have a paperless situation here, and that would be electronic transportation of materials, be sure and let Miss Betty know. So. You can go ahead and adjourn.
All right, then
there's
I guess
nothing else.
We are adjourned. Let's go on.